The air is getting crisper, the apples on the tree are ripening, and green leaves are starting to lose their sheen. Also, the television ads are getting much more interesting. It must be football season.
Manning, throwing.
We hand it off to Herschel. There's a hole. 5, 10, 12. He's running all over people. Oh, you Herschel Walker. My God almighty, he ran right through two men.
This week, I dove into the Academy of Achievement's glorious audio vault and pulled out tape from two legends of the game, Peyton Manning and Herschel Walker. In some ways, they could not be more different. One retired just as the other signed his first contract. One grew up the son of a football player. One never knew a thing about the game until he found himself playing it. One grew up with money, the other without. One is black and one is white. One was a quarterback, one a running back. But they are both sons of the South and men of faith, with overlapping views about sports and education and hard work. And both could make you catch your breath when you watched them on the field. A Tale of Two Players on this episode of What It Takes, a podcast about passion, vision, perseverance, and this week, pigskin from the Academy of Achievement. I'm Alice Winkler.
Adam A., this child is gifted. And I heard that enough that I started to believe it.
If you have the opportunity, not a perfect opportunity, and you don't take it, you may never have another chance.
It all was so clear. It was just like the picture started to form itself.
There was no way in which a lie could prevail over the truth. Darkness over light. Death over life.
Every day I wake up and decide, today I'm going to love my life. Decide.
My advice is, if they're going to break your leg once when you go in that place, stay out of there.
And then along come these differential experiences that you don't look for, you don't plan for, but boy, you better not miss them.
I want to get as quickly as possible to two stories, one from each of our players, because these stories get to the heart of who these two men are. We'll start with Peyton Manning, who barely needs an introduction, but just briefly, here are some record-breaking numbers from his career. 539 touchdown passes, 71,940 yards in passing, 200 wins as starting quarterback, 5 MVP awards, and he has the distinction of being the only quarterback to take two different teams to Super Bowl victory. The last time with the Broncos in 2016, just before he retired from the game. Here's Peyton Manning speaking to students at the Academy of Achievement Summit in 2007, the year he won his first Super Bowl ring, playing for the Colts.
Unlike other businesses and professions, in sports, people are commonly celebrated for their promise rather than their production, for what they can be rather than what they've already accomplished. No one will be named corporate CEO, president of a university, or head of a hospital solely because of early potential. They have to prove their worth before being placed in that position of leadership. Well, in sports, athletes are offered scholarships in the eighth grade, drafted in the professional ranks, and signed multi-million-dollar contracts before they've even had a chance to prove their worth. Sometimes their promise comes to fruition, other times it doesn't. As an NFL quarterback, I'd played in 156 games, suffered 170 sacks, thrown 4,890 passes, 275 touchdowns, 139 interceptions. I'd watched countless hours of film, every touchdown pass, every sack, every interception, every throw to the right, every throw to the left, always making a list of what I can do to get better. In that time, the Colts, my team, had recorded 98 wins and 58 losses. And that's before we even earned the right to run out onto that field and take one snap in Super Bowl 41. And that's a road well traveled, a road with potholes and speed bumps, detours and new directions. One thing it didn't have, however, was shortcuts. There were no shortcuts. And it would have been easier at times to just give up. There's something that management experts call the destination myth. It says when you get to the top, that's when you're going to learn to lead. Well, I don't agree with that. It may be normal to think, but it's counterproductive to either exaggerate yesterday or overestimate tomorrow. Leadership is a journey, and every success, every misstep, when put in the proper perspective, helps you become the leader that you want to be. And somewhere along the way, you need to be fed a heaping spoonful of inspiration. And my inspiration came from my older brother, Cooper. Cooper's 2 years older than me, and he's always been my hero. Taught me about sports, taught me about girls, and anything along the way. He was also an All-American wide receiver in high school, received a scholarship to play football for the University of Mississippi. His senior year in high school, I was a quarterback on the team as a sophomore. I completed 120 passes that year, and I threw 90 of them to my brother. The other receivers didn't like Cooper very much, needless to say. Well, in the middle of his freshman season in the football year at Ole Miss, he was diagnosed with a spinal stenosis, a narrowing of the spinal canal, congenital condition, something he was born with, they just discovered. And he was told that his football career would now be over. And this was very difficult news for Cooper and our family to take, because growing up in a football family and Cooper's love for the game of football, to be told your career is over without anything you could control was very difficult. And the night that he came home and my dad delivered the news to him was extremely difficult. And so I wrote a letter to him. I couldn't face him face to face. I had to write a letter to him. And I just told him that I was sorry and how much I loved him. And he wrote me back a letter, and he said that he'd be okay. And he said that he'd like to live his dream of playing football through me. And I still have that letter, and there's not a day that goes by, not a practice, not a game, that I don't treat it like it's my last practice or last game. And that's why I work as hard as I possibly can. I'm the first to arrive, the last to leave. That's why I have a real passion for the game of football, and that's why, even though I wouldn't tell my owner this, I would play for free. But all because of the words my brother wrote to me in that letter. And I owe that to him, because that's the way Cooper wanted me to be. Cooper went on to have successful neck surgery, stayed at Ole Miss, and became a social legend. And now is married with three kids and a very successful businessman. But let nobody fool you. Courage is required. And for what, you may ask? Courage is required to forego celebrity for true leadership, to choose those things that have value over those things that are only valuable, to make history and not just massage history. Don't ever let your potential haunt you. Instead, make certain it energizes you, because this world urgently needs genuine leaders.
We'll get back to Peyton Manning throughout the episode, but I promised a revealing story from each of our players today, and so let me introduce Herschel Walker. In 1980, he was the most sought-after high school player in the country. He turned down offers from every major football school to stay close to home at the University of Georgia. The team, with Walker playing as a freshman, came out of left field to win the national championship and then conference championships the remaining 2 years Walker played with them. He won the Heisman Trophy in 1982, was All-American three times, and is still, 35 years later, considered one of the all-time greatest college players. During his time in the NFL, Herschel Walker was running back for the Vikings, the Eagles, the Giants, and the Cowboys. He retired in 1997, the year before Peyton Manning was signed to the Colts. And let me take a moment for some Academy of Achievement bragging rights here. When Herschel Walker was still in high school in tiny Wrightsville, Georgia, the Academy honored him as a promising future leader. Several times over the years, he returned to the Academy, a hero to the next crop of students.
Well, it's strange. I had a speech impediment when I was growing up. I could barely put a sentence together. I could barely talk. But my parents wouldn't let that be an excuse. They said, you have to work on it. I had a lot of teachers that really didn't pay that much attention to me. You know, having a speech impediment, they just just figured then, you know, it's going to be tough for Herschel, so we'll put him over there in the corner sort of, and, you know, we'll work with him when we got time after we work with the other kids. You know, even though that may have disappointed me in their views, it didn't disappoint me in the way my parents said, Herschel, you just studied this, you studied that. My speech got better. My grades came up. And when I graduated high school, I was valedictorian in my class. I went into college with a very high grade point average because I knew the work ethics that it took. I knew that as long as you apply yourself, from what my parents have told me, as long as you apply yourself, you're going to succeed.
In interviews with the Academy in 1991 and 94, Herschel Walker described some of what it took for him to overcome his speech impediment. He would sit in front of the mirror day after day, night after night, practicing, "She sells seashells by the seashore." But that was only half of his battle against the bullies who laughed at him. He was also a chubby kid with no athletic ability. Then came seventh grade.
They have this race at the end of the school year, like a mile run. And, you know, I felt that if I can win that mile run, I have all these friends, people going to come and talk to me because I won the mile. So about 3 weeks before the race, my father was a farmer. So he plowed this field, and I got out, went into training with my younger brother. We went out and we went into training so I could get ready to win this mile. For 3 weeks, I trained. Finally, the day came for the race. I got up there with this guy, Willie Jenkins. I remember his name, and this other guy, Wells, who everybody predicted they were going to win the race. They were the most athletic kids in my class. And I got up there right with them to run this race, and we started running. And I was feeling good. I was feeling great. I was in shape. No one knew I've been training except my younger brother. So we were running around the track, and about the second lap, something said, Herschel, you're not going to win. I'm running, and I'm thinking, okay, wait a minute. Third lap, something said, Herschel, you're not going to win. And I'm up front. There's only like, I'm in the second place. I'm right up front. I'm feeling good. I'm not even tired. And going into the last lap, something said, Herschel, you're not going to win. You're not going to win this race. You better get out of it. You better get out of it. So right on the bike side of the finish line, I started thinking, oh, geez, I'm not going to win. So how can I get out of this race without embarrassing myself? And I'm like in second, whereas I probably could have won it if I had kept running. And I said, okay, what am I going to do? I'm going to pretend like I pulled a muscle. So on the last curve, I walked off the field and grabbed my hamstring in seventh grade and pretend like I hurt my leg. And Willie Jenkins ended up winning his race, and all day it bothered me. And when I remember going home, getting off the school bus, my younger brother ran up to me and said, how did it go? How did it go? And I said, well, I hurt my leg. And I lied about it. And he said, oh, you know, you'll get them next time. You know, and that made me feel so bad. You know, I lied, and then, you know, and I think the thing is I didn't try. And I said then, no matter whatever happened in my life from then on, I don't care what happened, I'm going to give it everything I got. You know, I see so many people today that don't want to try. It's so funny because people think I'm crazy because I do so many crazy things, but I think because of that race in my life, you know, I'm what you call the renegade of professional sports. You know, I've done everything, karate, dance, to just about anything. Now, I'm not going to say I'm the best at it, but I guarantee you I give most people to run for their money at just about everything.
The benefits of Herschel Walker's newfound determination came fast and furious. Even though he'd had no interest in athletics before that summer of seventh grade, he knew it was the way to be acknowledged by his peers. All he wanted to hear was, "Hey, Herschel, how you doing?" when he walked down the hall. His family and his school were too poor for training equipment, but he figured no one had a Nautilus machine in ancient times, so he started training the old-fashioned way, doing push-ups and sit-ups during television commercials. Eventually, he built up to 2,000 a day each, sometimes topping them off with 1,000 pull-ups and 1,000 dips, too. He became a machine. And more than what it did for his social standing, it changed how he felt about himself in the classroom and in sports. I love the metaphor he used during this interview to explain the transition that occurred within him.
So strange, because you can take two little dogs. One could be a small dog, the other is a small puppy, but he's going to grow up to be this huge 160-pound dog. And you can take this one 30-pound little dog that is an adult at the time, and this big dog, as he grow up, he's been dominated by this little dog. So he always grows up thinking this little dog could beat him. So he can get to his full size of 160 pounds. This little dog still, you know, is only like 30 pounds, but he still think, the big dog still think the little dog can beat him. So he's afraid of him because he don't know any better. And I said, sometimes that's the way the mind is if you continually to say you can't do it, you're not going to do it. But sooner or later, you got to make that, you know, like I said, you got to swing that bat because you never know if you're going to hit a home run.
Herschel Walker became the fastest runner in his high school and in the state of Georgia. When people pointed out that he was a little too big to be a runner, he didn't care. They didn't know him. He figured that when Alexander Graham Bell got a patent for the telephone, people underestimated him too and probably thought he was nuts. Still, it was unthinkable to Herschel Walker that athletics could be his profession. Who would possibly pay him to play football? For Peyton Manning, growing up in New Orleans, it didn't take any stretch of the imagination. He was the son of Archie Manning, quarterback for the Saints and later the Oilers and the Vikings. But what both Herschel Walker and Peyton Manning had in common was the unflinching support of their parents and extraordinarily close families.
My dad always told me and my two brothers, don't ever get too proud or too old to say that you love me, and to say that you love each other. So that, love was a pretty commonly used word in our family. You know, when I talk to my brothers now on the phone midday, we always end the conversation, say, I love you, you know, love you, bro.
And his parents did everything they could to create a normal childhood for their kids, despite Archie Manning's celebrity.
It felt normal to me. I mean, sometimes it's not normal when you're out to dinner and people come up and, you know, talk to him and get his autograph. And that's not normal, I guess you would say. But it went times when you weren't in public, very normal, you know, dinners, ate dinners, a family, always had to get up for breakfast and eat breakfast as a family. My dad used to read a daily devotional to the family. I mean, just, you know, try to keep things normal. Now, when you were out in public, you had to be prepared for what came along with that. I mean, when I was playing 7-8-year-old baseball and you know, on a travel team in the state or, I mean, everywhere you went, you know, my dad's in the stands. I mean, he's either still playing quarterback for the Saints or just retired, but, you know, still very popular guy. I mean, people knew who I was, you know, and kids liked to strike me out, or, you know, they liked it if I made an error. And you know, it was probably a little bigger deal than if their shortstop made the error. So I learned about it at a young age. It probably made me work a little harder at times, so I didn't, you know, mess up. And because, you know, nobody likes to be embarrassed, you know. And so when everybody knows who you are, you could be more easily embarrassed because more people are looking at you. So it may have motivated me to work a little harder. I knew people were always looking at me, so it made me kind of think twice about the things that I did. That was a positive out of it, especially for the life that I'm in today. You know, people are always watching. I mean, you know, it wasn't the cell phone camera back then like it is today as an 8-year-old, but it was a good learning tool about making the right decisions. So never felt it was difficult. You know, it helped the fact of what I'm doing currently, the fact that I got to watch my dad as a kid, how he handled himself after games with fans, with the media. I can remember as a kid just how patient he was and courteous he was to his fans. And so certainly didn't think at 5, 6, 7 years old that, you know, I would be doing that same profession. But at the same time, for Eli and I both, now that we are doing that, I remember just kind of how he handled himself. And remember just that, you know, my mother still today tells me to be nice, and they wouldn't ask for your autograph if they didn't want it. They'll stop asking for it at some point. So I feel very fortunate to have the kind of support I had as a child. Being the middle child, too, I felt was lucky have an older brother, Cooper, to kind of look up to, and younger brother, Eli, to sort of to be looked up to.
Eli, for any of you who wouldn't know a Hail Mary pass from a jump shot, is also a star quarterback and also the proud owner of two Super Bowl rings, which he earned playing with the New York Giants. His big brother Peyton was a good role model for him growing up, a sweet, protective, fastidious kid.
Always, you know, made my bed up, kind of always double-checked the locks on the doors at night and kind of fluffed the pillows if I was the last person on the couch, my mom would say. So kind of like things right. I'm still like that today. I'm a list guy, kind of a note-taker, organized kind of guy. So I guess I was like that as a kid.
Those qualities turned out to give him a real leg up when he got to be a quarterback, and they helped him perform better academically.
I did like school. I worked hard in school. I had to work hard in school, and it didn't come naturally to me. I mean, I could never not study for a test and expect to do, you know, even average. I mean, I was a grinder, as you would say. Now, I would, you know, might not study till that morning every now and then, but I would, you know, I mean, I'd get up at 5 if I had to. And I mean, I'm a preparation guy. I was taught at an early age about having a work ethic. And my dad used to give me a lot of quotes, you know, quotes just cut out of a newspaper article or out of a quote book and put them on a bulletin board. And the one that just kind of hit me at an early age, probably 10 years old, it said, it's by Chuck Noll, great coach for the Steelers. It says, pressure is something that you feel only when you don't know what you're doing. And that just kind of hit me right away. And, you know, I was playing baseball, basketball at that age. So it certainly applies to football today. You know, you don't feel pressure if you study the game plan and know what to do. But, you know, in school work, the same way. If you know what to do, if you put the time in and study, you really shouldn't feel pressure. Now, you might not ace every test or complete every pass, but you don't feel pressure.
Manning was so diligent and organized, he managed to complete his degree requirements at the University of Tennessee in 3 years while playing as star quarterback for the football team. It was a pretty sure thing he'd be the number one draft pick that year, but he chose to stay on for his senior year of college instead, and he has an interesting take on whether it was the right decision.
Probably the toughest decision I had to make at that time. And I just thought a lot about it. I prayed a lot about it. I sought a lot of advice from my dad. My dad kind of got me some phone numbers of some guys that I wanted to call, some other athletes that had been in that situation, some that stayed, some that went, and talked about, you know, hey, I regretted it, you know, or no, I did the right thing. I left early. So formed kind of a pros and cons list, and I like to write things down. I'm kind of a note taker. I think writing things down kind of creates that blueprint to guide you through the ups and downs of life. And just made my decision, and as soon as I make it, the one thing I do believe, I think it's up to you to make it the right decision after you make it. You know, to say I made the right decision right when you make it, how do you really know? You don't even ask that question. You say, I'm gonna make it the right decision by going out and doing it and working hard and not looking back and not second guessing yourself. So. And my senior year in college was great, very rewarding, great memories, friendships that I kind of solidified during that senior year. I stayed injury free, which that was probably the biggest question at times is what if you get hurt? And I just don't ask that question. You know, people ask me, what if you get hurt? I guess I get hurt, you know, but I never go to a game going, if you play that way, that's when you get hurt. So, but I just didn't want to be 50 years old and wondered what my senior year in college would have been like.
And he graduated as a member of Phi Beta Kappa. Not too shabby.
Well, I don't consider myself to be smarter than the next person. My wife went to University of Virginia. I always tell her because she couldn't get into Tennessee, as I joke with her. So, I worked hard. I worked hard in school. I went to college on football scholarship, and sure, you have goals and you have dreams, and I was kind of like most kids, you know, I wanted to play pro football or pro baseball, you know, just, but that was kind of, because that was your answer when they asked you that in class, what do you want to be when you grow up? I want to be a football player, but I was never on this mission to be a football player. I was never, or to say that I knew I was going to be a football player when I was 6 years old, forget it. People that say that, I still don't believe them. You know, you don't know as a 6-year-old or even as a 16-year-old what you're going to do. So I went to college. I said, I need to get a good education. I want to work hard in school because, like I talked about out there earlier, my older brother was, you know, had a neck injury. Football career's over like that. Nothing he did about it. Okay, he's in school at Ole Miss. He's working hard in school. He's got a lot of friends, and he was he could be happy without football. So that was kind of my approach, is I need to go someplace where I can be happy if my football career doesn't work out due to injury, due to poor performance. And so felt real comfortable there in college at Tennessee, and worked hard in school, and you know, studied hard and was very meticulous about the academic side of it. And so, yeah, to be named Phi Beta Kappa, I've always was always real proud of that, and still kind of consider that one of my, you know, proudest achievements.
Academic prowess is a point of pride for Herschel Walker, too, as you heard him say a bit ago. And when he talks to kids who want to grow up to be football players, he always puts that out there front and center.
I always say education is so important, because you can be president at 60. As a professional football player, they're going to say you're old at 32. They're trying to get rid of you then. But you can be president at 60. And plus, a football player do not just go play the game. He must become a student of the game. You know, they give you a playbook with 500 pages in training camp and say, learn this. Most guys can't learn it. Most guys do not make it. So they must have good study habits. And you get that through, you know, paying attention in school. That it's funny. I never said I was smart. I was valedictorian because I just paid attention. You know, I went to school, I sit there and I just shut my mouth and I wrote down things, and that was it. That's all you gotta do is go to class. But you just go and pay attention.
Herschel Walker said his only plan when he applied to the University of Georgia was to study criminal justice so he could become an FBI agent. No matter that he had college football recruiters banging down his door, literally landing their helicopters in tiny Wrightsville, Georgia, population 2000, the notion of sports as a career was way outside of his worldview until the first time he took the field at the University of Georgia.
Well, coming from a small town, it was tough really to dream big. You know, my biggest dream, you know, I grew up in a small town in Georgia. My biggest dream was one day to be able to go to Atlanta, Georgia. You know, to be able to go to Atlanta, which Atlanta was about 2 hours, 45 minutes from my home. So, you know, the dream about going to Atlanta was it. Coming from a small town that was big in farming and also big in clothing factories, you don't dream about being a professional football player.
He did briefly consider a life in the military, because that's where his classmates went, the ones who didn't want to farm or work at the factory. But ultimately, he told interviewer Irv Drasnin, he wasn't one to follow the pack.
I was a little different. You know, I used to write all the time. I was always by myself. And it's not that I wanted to be by myself, but we lived in a small town. We lived out in the country. There was no one around. So I sit at home, I wrote, whatever I can get my hands on, I read. And, you know, I just was a different little kid, I think. English probably was my worst subject. But I used to write a lot of poetry. I used to write poetry all the time. And it's something that just came to me. And a lot of people say, Herschel, you may be writing because you're depressed. Are you writing this? And I said, no, because I write happy things. You know, I write happy things. I write, you know, from love to death. Write about space. And, you know, I said, just when you're able to understand, life is a lot more beautiful then. When you're able to see a painting up on the wall and understand what you're looking at, it's a little bit more beautiful. So I used to, like, just read anything. I remember getting a Sears catalog and reading about how this was done and wearing stuff and just thinking, you know, I don't know how and why in the world I'm reading about women dresses, how to make women dresses. I don't think I'm ever going to become that. But, you know, just reading things, you know, I was just intrigued by it.
Did you have a favorite poet or a favorite poem?
It's not a poem, but something I read when it's about you know, the footprints in the sand. And, you know, and that has stuck in my mind so much because, you know, I think about it with friends, you know, where God is walking along with you in the sand and And all of a sudden, there's one set of footprints when you look back, and times are hard. And you ask God, you say, God, you know, when things were going well, you know, I look back, there was two sets of footprints. And saying, now that things are a little bit tougher, you've left me. You know, why? And God said, you know, it's not that I've left you. It's just that I'm carrying you. And that stuck in my mind because it is so strange how we sometimes just forget. And I think growing up, I think that's today is what keep making me drive forward. It's just thinking about the people in my hometown, you know, that encouraged me and the people that stood behind me, that helped me. And, you know, I said, I'm not going to forget those people because they knew me before anything. They knew me before anything, and they were right there with me. You know, no matter what, they were right there, and they were cheering me on. And, you know, they didn't care whether Herschel won that 100-yard dash. But as long as Herschel went out and competed hard, they were proud of me.
The people who held him up the highest were his parents. They gave him the inner confidence necessary for success and an industrious backbone. As Herschel Walker told interviewer Gail Eichenthal, there was no such word as lazy in his family.
I didn't have role models like football players in my life when I was growing up. You know, I never thought that, I never thought you can be a football player, so I never watched it, you know, as a little kid. But what I did see was my mother and father getting up early in the morning, going to work, and coming back late in the afternoon, and that they never complained about it. And what I did see is see my mother saying, you know, I love God, and my father loving God. And so they put that love on me, and they threw all that on me to love God. And so my role models in life have been my parents because they never complained about anything they ever done. They were seven kids. You know, my father is so strange because my father had six sisters. He was the only boy. And when he was 12, his father was killed. So he took the responsibility to raise his six sisters. Never complained. Never said anything about it. And I say, you know, that's my role model in life. Those are people that I look up to in life that have given me this. And I think if I go out in life now and do something crazy, I embarrass them. I don't care about embarrassing myself. I don't care about embarrassing myself. But to embarrass people that I've drawn so much from, I think it destroyed me worse than anything.
It's beautiful. What about teachers? You talked about teachers that didn't believe in you. Were there any teachers that did?
There was a high school coach that believed in me. His name was Tom Jordan. And it was funny, I had two older brothers who was very athletic. And when Coach Jordan saw me and how clumsy and, I couldn't run, couldn't do anything, he just said himself, you know, if his two brothers are great at sports, Herschel got to have something. He's got to be good at something. So he used to come pick me up after Sunday school, after church, and on Saturdays, and make me go out to this track, and he'd work out with me, he played with me, and he made me feel good about myself. And he said, okay, you're going to do your homework here, you've got to do this here. And he was just like my parents, and he believed in me. And he the teacher that, they say, what teacher you have? And I say, a coach. And most people say, oh, geez, that's just sports. But that's not. It's that he was someone that was the role model, was the teacher in my life.
Wow.
You know, he means a great deal to me.
But I should point out, throughout these interviews and speeches for the Academy, Herschel Walker kept reiterating that no relationship has meant more to his life than the one he has with Jesus Christ.
The reason why, you know, you have some people get up and they tell you their life story, how they are sort of like a boxer always comes out, and he said, well, I was never a tough guy, and this guy stole my bike like the Muhammad Ali, so I went into boxing, and next thing you know, I'm the heavyweight champion. You know, anyone can do that. I don't mean anyone can do it, but anyone can do like one of those stories. But no one can die and come back alive again. You know, it hasn't been done yet. There's only one person that has done something like that. So that inspired me. I said, hey, this guy's my hero. If he can do that, you know, I'm going to believe in this guy here. And to see him who can help the blind to see, you know, people that are sick, he can cure them. So he became a guy that I looked up to.
For Herschel Walker, devotion to God is in everything he does, including an 84-yard touchdown run. You can hear it when he describes what it feels like to have the ball in his hand, or when he answered Irv Drasnan's question about whether there was a single moment when Walker realized he had a special gift as an athlete.
I still don't think that was a moment, because I don't think I'm anything special. It's so strange, whereas I think anyone could do it. And it's just my belief. I think anyone can do it if they really dedicate themselves. I'm talking mentally, physically, it takes a lot of hard work. And I say you just got to dedicate yourself. And it's so strange. And I think that's why I never let anyone read my poetry. Or I never let anyone see it, because I don't think they can ever understand it. And you know, when I speak about this here, people think I'm absolutely crazy. But I say, you know, sometimes mentally I can get so, I don't drink. I never tasted alcohol. I don't smoke. I never do any of that. But I can get so high off my belief and my will that it's almost like you're invincible. You know, I'm so high off God that I don't care what you do to me, you can never destroy me. You know, I don't get nervous. I don't, knock on wood. This is so weird. I don't get nervous before a game. I get excited because this is an opportunity for me to go out there and show what the Lord has done for me. I'm so excited because the Lord has given me this ability. I'm so excited just to go out there, you know, to put on those shoulder pads, put that helmet on, and then go out there and go with it. And you know, it's funny because it's like, it's not in my nature. I'm more of a low-key, you know, but when I get ready to perform, I don't care if there's no one in the stands. I want to go out there and play because I'm ready to go out there and, you know, to get better. And, you know, it's like a high, you know, when you're running the ball sometimes, you know, you don't even feel, you can't even see behind you, but you can feel a person there. You know, it's so wild where you can just feel things. You don't even have to see it. You know, you get the ball and like everything opens up for you. You can tell where everyone is at. And everything is, it's like everything is so slow, but yet you see it on film, it happens so quick. You know, you can tell like how many cleats this guy have on his shoes, but yet like it's so quick, you don't know how in the world you count it. You can see this guy coming to tackle. You can see his eyes. You can almost, you have time to even say what he's thinking. Sometimes the guy is saying, hey, oh, geez, how am I going to tackle this guy? Whether I'm going to hit him at the legs or whether I'm trying to jump on him and hold him until this. You can see all this, but yet you see it on film and it happens so quick. So it's like a real big high for me.
You ever afraid out there?
No, I'm not. Because, like I said, there's nothing they can do to me. You know, what's an injury? Everyone get hurt. So there's nothing they can do to me.
What's been your biggest challenge? What's been the hardest thing you've had to overcome?
The hardest thing I think I had to overcome in life? I think racism. Yeah, I think that's so difficult because I don't think anyone can ever understand it. And it's not the point that people don't want to understand it, but they don't want to touch it. So like that's a subject we can't touch. Let's get away from it. But, you know, it's there. And as long as it's there, you got to cope with it. So with me, I'm always the type of person, if something is in front of me, let me deal with it. Let's not push it under the rug or push it to the side, because no matter what, it's going to keep coming up. You know, if you never deal with that dirt up under the carpet, it's going to get larger and larger. And it's going to keep coming up. You know, little bit by little, it's going to seep from underneath that carpet. So you deal with it now, you know, and you're going to try to get those piles out. I think that's been the most difficult thing. You know, I grew up in the South. My senior year was a very big racial detention, you know, in my hometown. That was a very big deal. And, you know, it's tough, but you knowing who you are and you knowing that, you know, whites know better than you are, Herschel. You know better than they are. And I think the biggest thing that helped me to overcome is when it's all said and done, God is not going to have a list and say, oh, geez, you're white, so you're going in. You're black, you're not. Or you're black, you're coming in. You're white, you're not. You know, God don't care. And, you know, my mother once told me, and I know this is almost similar to it, is I was going to church one Sunday, and I didn't want to go. I was tired of going to church and stuff. And I hid my shoes. I didn't want to go. And it's funny because I went to my mother and she said, oh, you ready to go to church? And I said, no, I can't go. She said, why? I said, you know, I don't have any shoes. You know, you only have one pair of Sunday shoes. And I said, I don't have any shoes to go. And she said, no, you can come on and go. I said, I don't have any shoes. She said, you know, God don't care how you look. And I thought about it, and you know, that's true. God don't care how you look. And that's what, he don't care whether you're white, black, pink. As long as you've been a good person, you believe in him. And I said, that's the key. And we always, I think we're always putting category. We got to put someone in a category. Okay, he's this, he's that, he's this. You know, that's, that doesn't matter. As long as he can do the job.
You've had a lot of great moments in your career. I wonder if you can tell us what are some of the most exciting achievements.
My most exciting achievement is being on the Olympic team in bobsledding.
Wait, what? Yeah. Herschel Walker, while he was playing pro football, decided he really wanted to be in the Olympics. So he set his sights on bobsledding, threw everything he had at it, Herschel Walker style, and in no time, he made the team.
At the start, USA 1, Herschel Walker, the brakeman for Brian Scheimer of Naples, Florida. This pair considered the best hope for a medal for the United States in the bobsled competition.
You know, there was a lot of controversy going on whether I should have the chance to compete on the Olympic team and this and that. And I say, you know, my problem with that is when you try for an Olympic team, I think they ask for the very best the United States has to offer. And if there's guys that's been practicing for years and cannot beat me, who's only been practicing for a few weeks, they do not deserve to be on the team. And to have an opportunity to go and become the best pusher for the U.S., I think was my biggest accomplishment. And then I think dancing in the Fort Worth Ballet.
What? Yeah, he did that too, as well as some mixed martial arts, by the way. The ballet was just a one-time performance, but the New York Times and other papers gave him a pretty good review.
Ballet is probably the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. And when I was asked to dance in the Fort Worth Ballet, I first declined. And then they asked me to come to the first rehearsal. So I went, and after being with professionals, I said, I better decline because there's no way I could do it. And I stayed with it, and I finally performed with them. And, you know, and people always said, why you never said the Heisman Trophy? Well, I never said the Heisman Trophy because, you know, as a freshman, they said Herschel should have won the Heisman Trophy. As a sophomore, they said Herschel should have won the Heisman Trophy. As a junior, Herschel wins the Heisman Trophy. And I said Herschel in third person because that's what people say about me all the time. But I feel my junior year, did I win the Heisman Trophy or did they give it to me because they say he should have won it this year, he should have won it that year, so let's give it to him now. Even though I had a good year, but, you know, I don't know whether I won it because I deserved it. So I never said Heisman Trophy, and people get upset about me about it, but I'd say I must tell the truth. My mother's going to get upset with me.
There must be some football moments that stand out.
Oh, football. I think winning the national championship as a freshman. You know, I was a starter on a freshman team that ended up winning the national championship on a team that no one picked to do anything. That was amazing. And what that taught me was that it doesn't matter what people think about you. Absolutely do not matter what people think about you. What matters is what you think about yourself. Because everybody on that team felt that we were the best team in college football. No one else outside that team felt that, but we all felt that way. So I learned then what matters most is what you feel about yourself, not what someone else feels about you.
And he learned the meaning of the expression, you're only as strong as your weakest link.
There's 45 guys on the team, and I made a statement to my teammates that if there's one guy that don't believe in we can win, I don't want to play with him. Because I don't want your negative influence over the other 44. I don't want a negative atmosphere around me. You know, I want something positive. I don't care if we're losing, but I want something positive. I want you to believe we can win. Because once it happens, it's going to happen. It's going to happen big. And I don't want no one that's going to be that you have to carry. Because sooner or later, you're going to get heavy. Now, I can carry you a little ways, but sooner or later you got to stand up and say, I got to carry myself the rest of the way.
Of course, even with the best teamwork and the most arduous effort in the world, losses do happen. And with them comes the barrage of criticism from the Monday morning quarterbacks. Both Peyton Manning and Herschel Walker talked about avoiding press coverage, both good and bad, and how they found equilibrium in the wake of disappointment.
The thing that gives me peace of mind at night after a game or after a season is that I knew that I did everything that I could to get ready to play that game. I couldn't have prepared harder. I couldn't have studied any more tape. I couldn't have spent any last minute details talking to my receivers about. I mean, I went into that game ready. Boy, I'd love to have this throwback, or God, I wish, you know, we just could have gotten in the end zone on that play. But I don't sleep well that night, but I can sleep knowing that I did everything I could to get ready.
The way I deal with it is you can't satisfy everybody. You know, growing up, I knew you can never satisfy everybody, so I'm not going to try to satisfy everybody. I'm going to go out and do the very best athletically on the field as I can for my teammates, my friends, for me. But, you know, if someone don't like it, I can't do anything else, you know. And I say, you know, everyone, we try to satisfy everybody. You can't satisfy everybody. That's tough. That's tough to do. And if you do it once, you're going to be doing it all your life. And I think I started out early not doing it. And I think today I'm able to, when I hear the criticism, I'm able to let it run off my back. Because I said, someone that is criticizing, I'm not doing what they're supposed to do. You know, if we're running a race and he's thinking about, oh, geez, Hershey's running with his knee not in the correct way. Sooner or later, Hershey's going to be easing up in front of him because he's not concentrating on what he's supposed to do.
You know, I read a statistic. They had a ranking of quarterbacks. It was a great statistic. And the statistic was the percentage of a touchdown drive after an interception. And to me, that's a telling statistic. And the guys that have a high percentage are the guys that have short memories. You know, they talk about having amnesia as a quarterback. You better move on from it. I mean, it's hard to say you forget about it because I think you need to. You want to learn from it. You want to address it. You can't just say, "Hey, it never happened." You know, when you throw an interception, I mean, first thing I say is, you know, now why did that happen? Was that my fault? Was that a poor decision by me? Was it bad luck? A tip ball, for example, or the wind, you know, literally blew the ball to the guy, or was it a miscommunication, you know, and it always comes back to the quarterback, you know. Usually, I mean, I'm going to feel like it's my responsibility because if the receiver ran the wrong route, I'm going to say, well, that's my fault for not being sure he knew what to do. But you better be able to put it behind you right away. Otherwise, it's going to drag you further down. An interception, a loss, you name it. You deal with it, you learn from it, you address it, and it's hard to get over, especially a loss. It is hard. When you spend so much time during 1 week, late night studying, film preparation, weightlifting, practice for a 3-hour game, which you only play half of, and you lose on a field goal, they're frustrating. That is very frustrating. But and you don't get to play to the following Sunday is a problem. Sometimes I'm always kind of jealous of baseball players. Like they get to play the next day and go out and do something about it. Football is a long time to stew over. But you kind of take Sunday night, maybe a little bit of Monday. But we always say our rule is the pouting has to stop Monday at 5 o'clock. You better be moving on to the next opponent. Now, when you lose the last game of the season in the playoffs, you're allowed a little more time to pout. You're allowed, you know, in the late January, maybe February, into March, but once the off-season program starts for the following year, you better be over that hangover and ready to move on. And same thing, what do we need to do to get better?
Peyton Manning says it's just as important to move on from celebrating your wins as it is from mourning your losses. Because either way, your sights need to stay set on the work ahead. Even when he sat down for this conversation in 2007, pretty fresh off his first Super Bowl win, Manning was already pretty low-key about it. But the interviewer pressed him to revel just a little.
You know, it's just nice to be able to, as a team, to do something together that you've wanted to do for a long time. I think that's been the most rewarding part about it, is being with my team. In the weight room, out to dinner, playing golf, kind of looking across at some of my teammates and knowing what we did and how we did it together. Maybe the best part about it is I haven't had to answer some of the dumb questions that I've had to answer. you know, people try to analyze your look. Well, I could tell what you were looking. I could just see the, you know, that huge relief off your shoulders. And I said, well, you might have seen that. I sure didn't feel that, you know. I never got in. I don't know what monkeys on backs mean. I don't, another expression that is just developed in sports media that I just can't agree with. I don't know what it means. I don't get it. I've never felt that. I've worked as hard as I possibly could every year to be the best player that I could be to try to help my team win games. I didn't work any harder this past year than I did in previous years. My team played outstanding at the right time, and we got hot, and we accomplished our goal. But I didn't feel like that, you know, it was this huge change in my life because of what happened. I felt very humbled by the whole experience, humbled and fortunate to have been on a team that had a chance to accomplish that.
For both of these guys, Peyton Manning and Herschel Walker, it really all just kept coming back to the work, the relentless, over-the-top, Herculean sweat equity necessary to live out big dreams. It's a message both of them give to kids who want to grow up to be them.
To dream, it takes work. To have a nightmare, you don't have to do anything but just hide in the closet. And I said dreams are possible through a lot of hard work. It's funny because people pray sometimes. People will pray, and yet they're going to sit there with their hands out hoping God is going to drop money in their hands. But that, it doesn't work like that. If you're going to pray, you got to get out and do something. You can't just sit in the bed. So that's, you know, that's what is so strange. If you're going to pray, you got to make an effort. And, you know, that's the way it is. If you're going to dream, you got to make an effort.
That's running back and Heisman Trophy winner Herschel Walker talking to the Academy of Achievement in 1991 and 1994. He retired from football in 1997. These days, he's a businessman who owns a company called Renaissance Man Food Services. In 2008, he published a book called Breaking Free, where he bravely talked about his struggles with dissociative identity disorder, a mental illness he was diagnosed with after he left professional sports. Today at 56, he keeps up his NFL training routine, 2,000 push-ups and 2,000 sit-ups a day. My inner slug is weeping. We're going to let Peyton Manning take us out of this football edition of What It Takes with a gracious answer to a question he has surely been asked too many times. What do you talk about in the huddle anyway?
The thing is, you have to, you know, understand that these guys are going to know the situation. I mean, to get in there, I mean, I think sometimes there's wasted talk. Hey, guys, we really need this one right here. Well, if it's 4th and 5 and there's 5 seconds left on the clock, I think it's pretty obvious that you need this one. So, you know, you better serve yourself saving your breath or talking about the specific football play. So, you know, I've been mic'd up for games before. I think everybody's looking for this super motivational line somewhere in the huddle. You're probably not going to get that from me. You're going to get more football jargon from me. I think less is best and say things that are meaningful. You know, the last one, I gave kind of the first play of the Super Bowl when we huddled kind of out there on the field was I just said, guys, I said, we're playing for a lot of people tonight. We're playing for our families, we're playing for our hometowns, your high school coaches, you name it. I said, most importantly, let's play for each other. Let's play for each other tonight. And let's have fun, let's work hard, and let's bring this championship back home. And so, you know, that was... Yeah, I didn't think a lot about it, didn't plan for that. You know, there's no notes in the huddle. You know, it's kind of, it's speaking from the heart, I guess you'd say. So, and I think once you say something like that at the beginning, there's you know, there's not much more to say. I mean, you go out and do your job.
That's quarterback legend Peyton Manning. He retired from the NFL in 2016 at the age of 40, and he's still figuring out his next moves. But meanwhile, he devotes time to the Payback Foundation he started, giving grants to programs for children at risk in Indiana, Tennessee, Louisiana, and Colorado, communities that have been important in his life and career. And according to a recent interview, he's serving as an assistant coach for the flag football and soccer teams that his sons play on. Makes you wonder, who's the head coach? I'm Alice Winkler, and this is What It Takes from the Academy of Achievement. Funding for What It Takes comes from the Catherine B. Reynolds Foundation. Thanks to them, and thanks to you for listening.